netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Wow, almost halfway through the year. The year seems to be going awfully fast for us. Last year at this time, we launched FXPhD.com, our training site. Now this year, we're in full swing on our fourth term with 15 courses underway. Pretty amazing. Survived NAB. I think the podcasts were a lot of fun this year and hopefully gave you a good perspective on the show. So you know, with these podcasts, we try to cover a wide range of visual effects, from software, hardware, techniques, breaking news, whatever we can cover. We try not to just chase the latest features, although we certainly have covered our share of the tentpole pictures and we'll continue to do so throughout the year. A few months back, we talked to the people over at Zoic about a new television show called Drive, which unfortunately got canceled. I think it's much more complicated to keep a show on the air these days than to figure out how to do them. Anyway, so if you're looking for that show, stop, because it lasted about 2 weeks, but no fault of Zoic's or Mike's. Anyway, this week we're going to talk about a show that's an unbridled success, that we've gotten just tons of requests to do this podcast. Heroes. The show's already been renewed for next year. There's great interest in this show. The visual effects are outstanding. Mike got to talk to a couple of Marks over at Stargate Digital. First, Mark Kolpak, the visual effects supervisor, and Mark Statney, the supervising producer. So, we're going to cross now to Mike interviewing Mark and Mark. And to make it more confusing, this is Jeff, but I'm going to ask Mike to call me John.
Thanks for that, John. And I've got, actually two Marks on the line. Hello, Mark and Mark.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Mark Spatney, if I could start with you first as the supervising producer of the show. I just want to get some quick background on Stargate Digital, and certainly to alleviate any confusion that relates to the name for those that don't work in Los Angeles and don't already know your work.
Sure. Stargate Digital is a visual effects company that was started, I think about 14 years ago, long before I was here. And some people get us confused with the movie Stargate and the two TV shows. There's actually no connection. Interestingly enough, they had to ask the owner of our company for permission to use that name because it was trademarked before that movie came out. But anyway, we are a visual effects company in South Pasadena, California, just about 20 minutes outside of Hollywood. And in addition to doing the effects for Heroes, we also do ER, Grey's Anatomy, Ugly Betty. Right now we have a couple of new shows in production, Mad Men, Grace, a show called Night Shift. We do Monk and a bunch of other shows. At any given time, we're working on maybe 15 to 25 shows.
Yeah, and you've just done some outstanding work. And let's focus on Heroes because really your role there is extraordinary. You're not only dealing with episodic television, but dealing with sort of feature film level and volume of effects. Tell me, how many shots have you done so far for Heroes?
We just added it up the other day. It was 1,122 shots for the season.
And 1,000 shots would really, get you a good feature film there. This is an enormous amount of work. And was there 23 episodes in the first series? I'm not quite sure. Was it 23 or 24? It was 23, right. So clearly your work started back at the pilot stage, and now the show is a runaway hit. Tell me, could you talk to me a bit about how the show is made, like what format's shot on and sort of how you go about doing the post?
Oh, sure. The show is shot on 35mm film. And then telecine to D5 tape the show offlines in their Avids at NTSC, and then we online to HD cam tape, and everything's finished in HD video, 24p.
So is your deliverables on the EPS to the network actually a HD master?
Yes.
So there's really nowhere to hide, is there, on doing a high def material like that?
No, there's really no place to hide. And what a lot of people don't realize is that although technically, a feature film frame is more pixels than in HD, the actual projection area, what goes through the projector and appears on the projection screen, is really about the same number of pixels. It's almost identical. So our work has to look as good, especially now when people are using 65-inch TV screens and stuff.
Absolutely. There's been a huge growth in widescreen and plasmas and stuff. And not only that, but a show like this is going to have a second life, no doubt, on DVD. And certainly it's on iTunes and other places where people can step through frame by frame. And such a dedicated fan base is no doubt likely to do that to your effects work.
We definitely have our share of TiVo fanatics who go frame by frame, and actually I see on the internet people posting individual frames of our stuff and having their hypothesis about how we did certain things and questioning the technical issues and shots and all of that.
Well, as phenomenally interesting as the series is, and it has its own conundrums and questions, what we find really interesting is how you've gone around doing the visual effects. Tell me, how does each ep get actually posted? Are you doing an A-B checkerboarding, or is it just sequential through the facility?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, are you,
for
example, if you had, say, episode 3 and episode 4, is episode 3 completed before you start on episode 4, or do you have a team that works on...
Oh, yeah, we're often working on multiple episodes at the same time. They try as much as possible to separate the episodes, and at the beginning of the season, you'll find that you're working on one show at a time, but as you go throughout the season, the post schedules will compress, and maybe because one episode ran long, or the network decided to move the order of shows around or something, all of a sudden we'll be working on three or four shows simultaneously. Even we might be doing the finished shots for one show, getting another show sort of lined up in the temp stages, and then doing a little R&D for another show.
Well, if I could, I might jump over to the other Mark in your role as visual effects supervisor to discuss some of the shots, because I'm sure. Terribly interested to know how you've pulled off some of these shots.
Sure.
The first one that really got my attention, and it was quite early on, I think, in the series, were the suspended times that
Hiro
Nakamura... Right. And he suspends time, and I could buy that on a normal rig if you'd shot multiple cameras and done a traditional
sure.
kind of bullet time, but you were moving
right.
through the shot that was defying
right.
the ability to do that. How'd you pull it off?
Well, one of the challenges is as you know, is that, you know, this is television, and so therefore there is not a whole lot of time to actually execute these kinds of shots within a normal production day when they're doing somewhere between, you know, 40 or 50 setups a day. So the setup of a bullet time rig, it would be really cool, but not entirely feasible. So really what defines frozen time became one of the driving questions, and that really was answered by the fact that if the camera moves through space with objects changing perspective and that are frozen, you know, and defy gravity, then that would sell the shot. So Greg Beeman and I started talking about pulling this whole Tokyo street of frozen time, you know, scene together, and really it was about getting lucky in a few different areas. We had a bunch of extras. We had one little, you know, girl that was a bit player that was, you know, the focus of the scene. And so we had to put all these elements into play, people, the location, and anything moving would blow the effect. Even if wind was blowing on the trees at the time that we shot this, which in case with the one big shot where it's a steady cam down through the street following Hiro through the actual truck wreck, and the toys are blown out everywhere. This had to be achieved very, very carefully. So what we did is worked with Gary D'Amico, the special effects coordinator, and we went ahead and devised a bunch of special rigs to help balance people in awkward positions, either falling over out of the way, there might be a wire on this guy, there might be just a person on a little Vespa, and we had to create a little rig to hold the Vespa upright, or someone merely walking where the back foot that's going to be coming forward is off the ground a bit. And you can't have someone hold that without a little bit of assistance. So with these little tiny rigs, we were able to get people to feel comfortable. And when they were comfortable, they were relaxed. And we were able to get them very, I think, with a lot of luck. They when we said, you've got to be frozen, they were frozen. They didn't move. And there was no wind. And so, therefore, that part of getting the plate photography shot was done. And then after that, it was a matter of tracking the scene in Buju, creating the 3D robots, the 3D boxes that the robots came in, and of course the brown boxes that shipped all this stuff, you know, in all exploding out over the actual scene. And then one of the things that really sold it was not only are you traveling through the space, but yet Hero interacts with some of these objects. And that's what I kind of like to call immersive visual effects, that it's just not something playing in the background or played out in front. The fact that we help them say, okay, over here, look up this way, you're going to see a toy robot over here. Over here, you'll see this. So he looks at these things, but not only that, he bumps into a robot stationary in the air, and it moves, and a box pivots, and all this kind of stuff, which really kind of, you know, made it a much more successful shot and really tripped people out because they were like, my God, how did they do that? It's like, you know, the stuff's in the air, and it moved, and, you know, when he ran into it. So it was really a sleight of hand deal. It was really, you know, nothing really tricky with the actual shooting. It was just a lot of extras holding very still, and then of course, you know, placing these objects that are defying gravity, that are done in 3D with a changing perspective, so you came around it, which helps to sell the whole gag.
So it would have been a lot of roto and a lot of work to go over that moving sequence and remove those rigs, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we did is after we got, you know, we were happy with the actual plate photography, then I went ahead and did sort of like a clean, dirty pass, if you will. So I had the Steadicam operator. You know, we broomed everything out of the way, sans the truck just stayed where it was and all that kind of stuff. But everything else, you know, people and Vespas and bicycles were all pushed out of the way. And then, you know, basically it wasn't an exact registration because it's not motion control, but yet the operators are usually pretty savvy to get us enough of what we need, sort of close enough for horseshoes and hand grenades, if you will. So, you know, he went through and did and repeated his move, and then we were able to take that or pieces of that and then project it onto basically 3D geometry to lay in where something was occluded in some way that we needed to then patch it up. And it was, you know, critical because the perspective was changing on it or there's some kind of camera rotation. So in doing that, we were able to then, you know, of course, cover up and paint out whatever we had to.
Now, as you said, for the actor playing Hiro Nakamura, it was a good opportunity because he could clearly have his own eye lines sorted out because there were really people there. That wasn't a luxury that you had in another episode when he meets himself. Now, you said that you didn't use motion control in the first. Did you resort to motion control for the sort of what I call dual hero shots?
Yeah. What we did is this. In Paul Edwards' episode, which is episode 20, which is 5 years gone, there were two things. There was in episode 19, there was a little bit of a, you know, at the end of the episode where, you know, Ando and Hiro are in Isaac's loft. They hear something. They kind of go through the strings a little bit, and then you leave, you know, past Hiro, and you pan over, and there's future Hiro, and the two have essentially, you know, found each other. And that was essentially what we do here, is sort of a technically called a Stargate nodal pan, where you have a free camera move up to a point that you're going to lead into a visual effect, and then the camera sort of stops moving, gets into sort of a single axis move where it's just like a pan over, and we're able to then basically easily track in the second element, which was of course Mossy, you know, already clad in his future outfit against he was in against green screen over there, and so therefore then we just comp them in, track and comp them in, and it just looks like, you know, because there's no changing perspective, it's just a pan.
I mean, nodal pans are our friends, but that wouldn't have got you out of either the next episode or back when he met himself in the train, because you have quite complex camera moves there.
Yeah, so within string theory, or what became 5 years gone, that was a motion control rig. So what we did is I worked with Paul in saying, okay, well, who's driving the scene here? It was clearly Future Hiro. So we did all of Future Hero's work first. So it's Future Hiro and it's Ando. And we rehearsed it all out. And then based upon that, we shot using the Milo rig from camera control. And it ran up and down through Isaac's loft where all the strings were located. And it was, you know, a 4.5 minute master that this thing was shot on. Because, you know, Paul wanted, we wanted to get moments where it just wasn't, you know, that Disney picture where it was the two little girls, I can't remember what the name of it.
Oh, another one you mean, exactly,
yeah. Yeah, Yeah. So,
so it wasn't just split screen.
Yeah, exactly. We, you know, and we've done split screens before, and it's all fine and dandy. But this enabled us to have a bigger opportunity to do something more interesting and really fool the eye and make people, you know, say, God, how did they do that? Because, I mean, the camera's moving, and yet there's two heroes there, you know. So that was all motion control. And then, of course, you know, the actors did it, or I should say, we started off with no strings in the center. And it was Hero, Future Hero, and Ando, and then they did their stuff, and I had blue screen behind them as well. And then Monty went and changed and became Past Hero. Now, we also, sometimes the best visual effect in work is the acting, to be honest with you. Monty was really, really well prepared, and he knew exactly where he was as Future Hero. We had video assist set up so we could, you know, play this back and check it against itself so we can see where eye lines were and everything. But man, I'll be damned. That guy had it so well done. A couple times he was off, he was a little bit behind, but his eye lines, because he knew he's the same height as himself, so he knew where he was standing, so he was able to focus in on that. And he just nailed it. I mean, we only did Past Hero.
You are spoiled having an actor who has an background in visual effects, though.
Yeah, it does present some odd conversations with an actor that I've never had before, such as in the museum, we were working on what was called oatmeal time, where Hero's powers were kind of failing, and he could only slow things down,
yeah,
and not freeze them. And one night at the Museum of Natural History down here in at USC, you know, we had a green screen shot, and so it's going to be, you know, James, and it was going to be Mossy, and so Mossy was very tired, and he got kind of confused, and he comes over to me, and he says, Mark, don't you need to have me against green screen myself and James by himself? And I said, no, because you'll come over here, and this will take over here. And he goes, oh, okay, great, so I'm going to reverse that. You're going to reverse the hierarchy of the match structure and apply it to there. Okay, I got it. you know, something that you never hear from an actor. I mean, you know, so it does present some odd things. And actually, what was really kind of funny and cute and everything was, you know, because he has a huge computer programming, you know, background, and he's really quite brilliant at that, we had to make the Milo do some things that were sort of unconventional based upon the limited space that we have. It's a very big rig. And so we had to, like, you know, the pan had to be like a tilt, and it was all kind of convoluted and weird. And the programmer, who's also a very brilliant guy, this guy Simon, you know, was working on trying to get this thing to do what it had to do, and it's just a matter of just adjusting some things. But like Mossy comes over and takes a look at it and says, you know, if you give me some time, I can rewrite the code for this and make it work a lot faster for you. You know, so, and he's like, you know, I really appreciate that, but I only got like 10 minutes here to make this thing work.
You know? Getting back to that shot, like,
yeah,
you made hard life really difficult for yourself by putting string everywhere. I mean, the one thing a motion control rig doesn't want is something to block its movement. And
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Was any of that added back in post, or was it just careful choreography?
Well, what we did is that. It went sort of this route. We knew where Future Hero was going to be. So basically, they ran through, and also Mossy wanted to interact with the strings.
Right.
So I went, okay, so that's going to be something. All right. So what we did is that I had to get a map path for the strings. And I knew Future Hero was not going to interact with the strings. So basically, we put up the blue screen behind everything, so I had the strings and the blue screen. And then here, so now Future Hero is walking through. He can touch the screen. So it'll pull a mat. Everything is fine. And then, of course, then it was just a matter of just really aligning where Past Hero was going to walk, and that was okay because he was on the back side of the strings, and he always stayed on that side. So it worked out very well. So I had like a clean path, and I had a map path with blue screen with both actors and the strings. And then Past Hero, the strings were taken out, and it was just blue screen, and it was just Mossy there without the strings. So therefore, if they ever moved, they had their own mat, and of course, you know, they moved in front of Past Hero.
Right. Well, now let me just switch gears slightly and ask you about the future New York, or rather, and there were various times in various episodes that this has come up, that there have been flashes to New York being destroyed. There's actually one shot where there's like a rolling dust cloud engulfing buildings. I was wondering, sure. Do you shoot many miniatures, or is this all CG?
It was all CG. The foreshadowing event of New York being destroyed in episode 102 was basically what we did is we took their translite image, which was outside the Isaac's loft. We got a from the translite company. We got a digital image of it, and then we brought it in here and we sent it over to Matt Painting. Matt Painting went ahead and sort of readjusted it, repositioned buildings to give us a more distant view of the actual surrounding area, because the translate is actually very claustrophobic and the buildings are really kind of up in your face. So we opened up the view a bit, and then once that map painting was done, then we went ahead and projected certain buildings back over the map painting in 3D. And then we built some particles for that, and then the artists over there were sort of divided into a couple things. I mean, one artist actually dealt with the pyroclastic cloud element, which he became very, very good at. And then that pyroclastic element that he made interacted with the buildings that he had projected back over themselves onto 3D geometry that then, of course, he made a procedural particle breaking apart algorithm for that actually made it, you know, blow apart. So we just timed everything to when these clouds came through. And, of course, he would make one pass that would actually hold out the building, so therefore the pyroclastic cloud would go around, but then that presented its own problem because you end up with like a hole in your pyroclastic cloud because then the buildings blow apart and you've got nothing there. So then we had to go ahead and add another element in there that would kind of fill that in.
I must say, and I don't mean any disrespect to anyone on this, but it's a sensitive point, I know, but after 9/11, the haunting image is that dust cloud coming from the buildings going down. And so, of course, you are doing destruction in New York, and in later episodes there's a Ground Zero kind of set. So you must have been aware that there was, unfortunately, a kind of a real-world reference point that the audience had.
Oh, there was a completely real world. When in episode two, I was very sort of guilt-ridden over it because I just thought this was insult to injury, if you will. I mean, you know, I'm not going to lie, the pyroclastic clouds were an inspiration, you know, a gruesome one, if you will, that I took from 9/11.
I mean, it is what you now expect to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like what now you do believe would happen, whereas before you would always expect fire and flames. The general psyche, I mean, it's a pop culture almost of, not a pop culture, an actual culture of what we now expect to see if a large building or series of buildings were destroyed is a huge plume. So I understand
absolutely.
That's a completely valid reference, but still, I imagine it would have been sensitive issue.
It was a bit weird, I got to tell you. It was a bit weird, but it is New York, and of course New York is the city that everything seems to always focus on in every story of this kind, you know. So
it is such a great city. I mean, it's in real life, it's just a great place to be. So
it's wonderful. So I wondered how the audience and how the public at large was going to actually, if they were going to be receptive to this and say, okay, this is a story and it's fine, or were they going to be reminded of the horrors of 9/11 and it just to be sort of too close, and I guess, you know, we were able to make it maybe different enough, or just people or the context it was in, they were just really fine with it and thought it was a really cool effect, and that was great. And of course, yes, in episode 20, in 5 years gone, again, the Ground Zero was all rooted in the realities of the actual real Ground Zero. So even though, you know, it's not from the terrorists, you know, taking over planes and crashing them into the Twin Towers, you know, this was another kind of attack that had taken place. And so we just said, well, you know, real is real, and that looks fantastic, so let's make our work unique to the show, but yet use that as the inspiration.
Now, let's shift gears in terms of scale and go to something like Claire's characters, healing and tissue repair and stuff. Tell me, how was that approached and how much was that special effects makeup? Because I know that's very time-consuming to put on and would, again, slow down episodic television production.
Yeah, a lot of it, what we do here, is there's a company called Optic Nerve, and they're the special effect makeup guys. And we do a pass with the appliance and without the appliance. And generally what we always do is we always put the appliance on first because, you know, it just makes it easier to do that than it is to track on the actual piece if she's moving or whatever. Because generally, you know, they'll move to a point, settle, do something, and then the thing heals, and then you cut, and you're on to another angle of something. So, and plus it gives you points of reference to track from when you've got, you know, blood splatter or you have, you know, rough edges of things. The tracking system seems to like that and makes our lives a little easier. So, for instance, with, let's say, cutting Siler's, you know, sort of quintessential killing motif, if you will, his slicing off of people's heads, tops of their heads, we put on the scar first, the actual laceration, and the actor will perform and do his thing as needed. And then once that performance has been achieved, the camera stays where it is, the actor stays where he is or she is, and then we will do, the actor just stays still, and then we just basically squeeze in some blood into the actual laceration and let that drip down their face. And then with the camera still staying where it is, the actor goes off, the makeup person takes off the actual laceration, cleans them up, puts the regular makeup back on them. They come back into their position, and then we do a very just technical pass where they look straight ahead, then they turn their head to the left, to the right, up, down, and that gives us enough pieces in the lighting that we can then replicate that over the actual laceration and reveal it when the event's taking place.
And of course, for an actor who perhaps isn't a regular, any such script mention of this effect being done to them is not so good for their renewal options.
Right.
As it tends to be. But that means you've had to do that with a bunch of featured extras, effectively, or certainly character actors that aren't principal cast.
Absolutely.
And so there's got to be a bit of an education thing going on there because it would be not necessarily immediately intuitive how to approach that from if you were just an actor.
Right. I mean, you know, it's funny because the first time that we did this on camera was, I think, with Jackie, the other cheerleader, when she is sort of it's the first time that actually Zachary Quinto was cast as Siler, and he's in the locker room and she's held up against the locker doors and she's killed. And this all happens when Claire was knocked down and her face was all bashed in and stuff. So basically it was, I mean, instinctively what they want to do is they want to do their performance with the laceration. And then when the blood's coming down, she immediately started to want to shake and do her whole screaming and dying. And I go, you know, no, you don't have to on that. And they look at you like, really? I go, no, it's fine. This is the base layer. Now we're going to put everything on it. It's just like makeup. You apply your base, your eyeshadow, your this and that, you know, and you build up on it. So you don't have to do all of that. You did it already here. Now we're just going to get some pieces to add in. And they go, oh, okay. And they get it.
Well, now one of the other effects that we've seen a few times and certainly has been a mainstay of visual effects for many years is flying. How did you approach Nathan's characters flying and the other flying sequences that we've seen?
Well, the flying, you know, one of the things is that, you know, when I was put onto the show, I really wanted to do feature-level effects for television. It's just, you know, I thought there's an
And that shows, definitely shows.
You know, well, thank you. And I just saw this as an opportunity, and the quality had to be there. And even though you're saying it's television, there was something more about this show. There was something more that the clients weren't necessarily saying, but sometimes you have to read the subtext. You have to read between the lines of what the clients, because they would say, well, I can't have the billion-dollar, you know, effect that is in this feature, you know. But you got to give them something that is not playing down television, but feels like, you know, this is the absolute prime visual effect that you can get on television. So I knew that the best way to achieve the flying was not so much always resorting to a man on wires, because generally it takes a lot of time to actually get that performance to look right, and most of the time you always end up looking like a guy on wires. As hard as you try on a television schedule, you're not going to have the amount of time you need to actually work out a lot of the nuances that are required.
It's the ballistics, isn't it? You get a sort of a skidding effect because you don't get the ballistics right between the foreground composite and the background.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you just, you know, you shrink an object back, then you deviate, you know, you make it come back scale, and it just looks like it's just something shrunk and then, you know, brought back to scale. And sometimes we have to do it, and that's fine. But with Nathan taking off in episode 5, which you know, really has the description of, you know, basically, and before anyone realizes it, Nathan takes off, and before you can say this is the coolest show on the air, he's gone. And that was the inspiration that was written into the narrative of the script. And I said, you know, at the time, he was only in his boxer shorts, you know. So there's no place to put a harness, if you will. And I said, this is the perfect opportunity here to do a 3D synthetic double. So we went to production. They were a little bit hesitant about it. You know, I don't know if you can pull this off. And I go, no, it's Nathan, it's Adrian up to this point. And then, bam, and as he goes up, we transition into the 3D double, and you'll never know, it'll be fantastic. And they were still kind of dubious about it, you know, but they were willing to go along with it. And so we ended up, you know, they changed it from boxers to pajama bottoms. And so we sent Adrian over to Itronics, where he had a body scan and a head scan and textures and everything else done. And then Daniel Kumiga over here, who's the sort of the character animator, he went ahead and then, you know, rigged the model, skin textured, lit, animated everything that needed to be done for this model to make it, you know, stand up and hold up on television. And so essentially what we did is we did a match move. We shot Adrian against green screen out on the rooftop of this parking garage, and then we shot a stitch of the background that we could tile together and make our own move, because, you know, trying to have the camera operator just so you tilt up real fast and then come to a graceful stop was never going to happen. So easier to just say, hey, we got this here, he jumps in a lock, and now we just tilt us up, fantastic. Make our own camera move in post was the smartest way to go. And then the Daniel just basically did a roto animation of Adrian over him jumping in green screen, and then we just did a small little morph, and he takes off, and then basically we added that little sort of stage 2 shock ring, you know, as he takes off, you know, he lifts off and then boom, explodes to his regular speed and is gone. And you know, so it gave us a view of a person flying that hadn't been done before, at least on television, I should say, you know, where it just felt really like this guy just defied gravity.
And I'd like to chime in that after Mark was able to pull this off, the show embraced the idea of going to digital doubles. And so ultimately we ended up scanning several of the cast members and using digital doubles of them for various shots.
Yeah, because I was wondering about Nathan's brother when he's learning to harness his abilities and he's thrown off the building and he does a straight fall. Whether that was wire work or you'd done digital doubles for that as well.
Now that one was wire work.
Right.
When the Invisible Man Claude throws him off the building, that was actually, we hadn't scanned Milo yet. So we did that on our insert stage over here at the Stargate, and we shot him against blue screen, and we just created a lot of interactive light on him. And then when we composited it, it was really about blending or creating certain things that you would get if you were traveling with a person down the side of a building. And a lot of that was, you know, a buffeting effect, you know, which is a little bit of shake on it, which gave it a vibration, which made it seem much more real and much more violent, if you will, as he's been, you know, as he's basically plummeting, you know, down towards the taxi cab. And the background plates were shot using a descender rig. And we just shot, you know, straight in, straight up, and kind of a three-quarter, you know, to the building. And then based upon that, we matched the lighting to Milo, and and shot the pieces that we needed there, and then just did some careful compositing.
Because you have so much stuff around New York, do you get to film in New York, or is it basically let's make L.A. look like New York?
It's mostly make L.A. look like New York. I went back for a few days and shot some plate photography around the city for some of the Upper West Side, you know, locations that were later used in the Petrelli household. That, you know, when they come into the front doors, there's a street back there, and that's from the Upper West Side.
There's the famous rooftop set that is featured in so many episodes. Now that must be a stage item, right?
No, what it is this is I shot a stitch on a building top in New York. So we shot both digital stills and we shot moving footage as well, and that's all stitched together. And what you have there is you have the DeVoe set is surrounded with about a 200 and I don't know, maybe 270, 280 degree blue screen. I mean, basically the blue screen is 120 by 30 feet high.
Wow.
And yeah, it's quite big. So it covers a good three quarters of this set. Or at least 180 across if you directly cut it, actually. There's a lot of area to fill up, and some directors really like to shoot, you know, out that direction because they want to, you know, have the actors and the environment there. And so, you know, once we got these plates in-house and we worked on the plates and stitched it all together, added, you know, steam coming off of buildings, and then some shots we have birds going by, and there's airplanes, and we even, you know, put some people in some things, but mostly it's a lot of the trying to put a little bit of life. Sometimes the skies, you know, the clouds move, all that kind of stuff. But it's really one of the big things I think that sells it is just some of that little tiny movement back there that helps to make it alive. Because when I was shooting these, you know, stitches, you know, you look out at a rooftop of New York and it looks like a translite. Nothing moves. You know, you can't see in windows. I mean, there's no life really moving around. All there is steam coming off of, you know, certain pipes on these high rises and these other kind of buildings.
And the odd bird, hopefully.
And the odd bird.
And I'd like to just throw out there, what most people wouldn't realize is that fully half of our effects budget on any given episode is for establishing locations. You might not expect that, but we do a tremendous number of invisible effects. Basically, anytime it looks like it's New York or Las Vegas or India or, you know, any other Montana, any other location the show has gone to, that's us doing that. And it's one of the reasons why people come to Stargate Digital. It's actually become sort of our niche specialty is doing a technique we call the virtual backlot, which is allowing shows that don't have the budget or the time to go to locations, put their actors into locations. And we do it all the time for this show. If you see them anywhere that's not LA, that's us. If you see Ugly Betty in New York, that's us. If you see people in Chicago in ER, often that's us. Grey's Anatomy came to us to create a giant three-episode ferry crash story arc that was basically shot over a giant green screen, and we created the Seattle location and the crashed ferry and everything for them. So it is our specialties, letting shows open up their production location opportunities.
I must say, I think the Grey's Anatomy crash really gave an enormous amount of air to that show because it was getting a bit like how many times I looked down the same corridor in Seattle and general. And so getting out and having those big reveals really, and that's one of the great things with visual effects, isn't it? Just giving that establishing shot that gives the story a really good stage upon which to work from.
Absolutely. And what's kind of nice, the way things have gone, you know, with visual effects, and especially, you know, over here at Stargate, is the fact that, you know, you always had the obligatory sort of establishing shot of XYZ location. And then what you do? You cut inside. Now, you actually put the actors outside even though they're not even there. And then take them inside.
We'll do entire scenes over blue screen that people would never imagine. Like, well, we just finished one where we had 50 shots inside of Yamagata Industries. And you would think that we shot that in an office, but in fact it was a blue screen, and we created the office background environment for that. Linderman's office, which is this beautiful window panoramic 270-degree view of New York. Again, giant blue screen, and that's us putting New York back there. And it really makes the show look like it's taking place in all these locations. And the show really values the work that they put into production design. And when they do practical sets, the production designer, Ruth Amon, has enormous attention to detail, and they do these beautiful environments, and they don't want to lose that when they're doing visual effects. So it's on us to really live up to that, the detail that they put into the real sets.
In fact, I think
we did pretty well with that.
Yeah, thinking about it, it's almost like LA is about the only place that Heroes doesn't seem to have plot lines.
Right. We haven't gone. I think we went to LA once. I can't remember what episode it was, but yeah, we don't really. It's funny. We don't really focus too much on Los Angeles.
We were in LA to establish Matt as an LAPD officer, and then he got suspended, and we were out of LA.
Tell me, and just before I finish up with you, Mark, Mark, visual effects supervisor, Mark, what would you say was the most pleasing shot that you've worked on, or the most difficult shot, but certainly the one that you enjoyed? I know it's an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
I think it's a totally fair question. I mean, I'm proud of all the work that we've pulled off this season, but I think hands down the most impressive and challenging shots that we did was the Claire burning up and Claire healing. Because again, when we sat in the production meetings for this, you know, it was about scanning Hayden, doing a head and body scan, and on top of that, it was selling the idea that this would even work. A lot of people had skeptical thoughts about this. Yeah, I don't know about this. How are you gonna make this work? I don't see this really happening. And so they really wanted to go the safe route and have in their sort of back pocket two doubles at two different stages of burn for when she walks out of the house, and this was for the episode 117, Company Man, and so I always felt all along that doing digital makeup basically was going to be the way to go, and especially when you're dealing with a minor, which Hayden is, at least until August sometime. you know, she only has so much time to be on set, and you can't really have her do 6 hours of makeup and then get all the other stuff that has to be done with her. So we were shooting, Alan Arkus directed that episode, and he and I, you know, we're getting to where we did the girls who were in makeup first. So girl one came out and did the thing, and then girl two came out and did the thing, and it went great. Then, okay, Hayden, come on over. And within moments, I'm talking milliseconds, it seemed like, Hayden started to do her thing, and Alan and I looked at each other, and he said, the girls don't match her. And I said, no. And he went, damn. And so, because, you know, Hayden's a brilliant actress. She is really brilliant. And like I've said to other people, that when Hayden walks, she's just not walking. She's doing 25 things mentally to make it look like she's just walking. You know, but there is a performance going on there. There's a subtlety that she brings. There are nuances. There is just sheer talent. And not to discredit the girls who put the makeup on, because they were good sports, but it just wasn't going to match. And I'd always seen this as being sort of, you know, a one-shot deal where she's walking and she's healing in front of our eyes, so we can say, look, Ma, no hands.
Well, also, you know? this was a pivotal point in that episode, Company Man. This was not... This was the point of what had been a lot of screen time building up to this moment.
Exactly. So we ended up doing, like I said, the cyber scan of her head and body, and then we got the textures, and then I went over and on a Sunday I photographed her again, you know, and I took her in, you know, just normal beauty in a little bikini that she was wearing, and then, you know, so we get all the skin textures that we needed, and then did, you know, sort of a dirty pass that matched what she looked like out, you know, on location, and then we took all the appliance pieces, which I wanted desperately to use, and was thankful that they were created, because here it's a hand-in-hand process with the special effects makeup guys. So we put the pieces on her, you know, easily, photographed those, and then our 3D artists were able to take those textures, apply them to the 3D model, then match frame by frame basically a roto animation of the 3D double on top of Hayden. Hayden on top of Hayden.
Wow.
And so therefore, every head turn, every shoulder move, everything matched up as perfectly as we can get. We had to do a camera track. We had to do an object track, which was Hayden, and really make this thing hold and register and work. And then it became some very talented compositing by Eric Gennadier here, who put these pieces together and then did the blend. So as she came out, you saw her emerging and healing and everything else. And it was very funny because John Aronson, the DP, afterwards said to me, he said, boy, it's really a shame that you couldn't use, you know, Hayden on the first shot. You had to use a double. And I said, you think so, John? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, because that's Hayden. He goes, what? I go, look at the hair. That's Hayden. Is that's her one performance all the way through, and it's all digital makeup.
Now, let me ask you a couple of quick questions. What were you compositing on?
We use After Effects here.
Because I've got to say, one of the things that in that shot I imagine would have been really critical is not just the compositing in the sort of keying sense, but also the color grading, because skin tone matches are just so vital to pull a shot like that off.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the thing is that, you know, we work within the actual plate that is delivered to us, you know, because Lori Modier, who's the co-producer in charge of all the post-production, you know, wants to have latitude. And one of the most critical things is, and I made a call to the colorist. I said to him, I said, you can't bring this stuff up. I said, it will fall apart. You're talking about digital blacks versus blacks on film. And blacks in film have latitude. There are things in there that you can pull around and play with. When you have black on a digitally created element, it's just black.
So, you know? So what?
So
you're doing like a
10-bit
444 back to them, or what was your output frame?
Well, they give us the D5, which is 422.
Oh, 422. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, so we do everything here that we take that, and of course, you know, we would have preferred to be in a 444 environment because we have two SR decks here that we use, but that's the format that they want to work on. So that's fine. So we just let them know that based upon the color grade that was set up during the initial, you know, transfer of this material, is set where the blacks aren't crushed and the whites aren't clipped. And what we do essentially is that work within that and say, look, you cannot bring this up. If you try to lighten this, all the digital makeup will fall apart and look horrible. So I was really pleased to see that they listened to me, they didn't do that, and everything blended and looked like it fit perfectly. Because yes, we had to balance all the blacks and deal with the color. And even though the color was very much more dramatic, because when she first comes out, she's very much black and red, and so there's some other small hues in there, but it's pretty much what I call crispy eclair. you know, it's just, you know, she's just, you know, pretty much one big scab, you know, and she's got some crevices in there with a lot of red and that sort of thing. And then it's just with a lot of morphing it and blending it back, and then also doing some displacement maps as well to give a little bit extra texture on her skin as we move more towards, you know, complete healing. So therefore, it gave it a little bit extra.
And this particular sequence was probably the most scary one for us of the whole year. I remember when Mark came back from shoot going, yeah, we had the doubles, but they don't want to use them. We're going to have to go with a digital solution. I remember thinking, nobody does that on a television schedule. So it required us to really, you know, think about it. Almost immediately, we put a couple of our 3D artists to just spend a couple of weeks doing R&D for how could that skin healing look? How would we reveal different layers through it? How would we possibly match move that to the actress in time? And there was a bunch of R&D. And then once we had sort of something we were happy with, while the production was editing, when they finally had an edit, we had to carefully go to them and say, look, we can do this for you, but in the 10 days of post that we're going to have to do this, which is all we really had, from the time that they locked picture and said, here you go, make crispy clear, we figured we could do a certain number of seconds of match moving and pull it off and make it look good. So we worked with them to say, which are those key moments? How many frames do you really need? How many inside the house where it's burning, how many outside? And we got it down to, you know, exactly pretty much what we could pull off. And that was the one sequence where we were literally delivering right up against the deadline to when the shot had to go out to the network. But it worked phenomenally well.
Mark, now I'm glad you've chimed in. Sorry. I was going to ask Mark, because I'm glad you chimed in there. Because the company's well known, you've got a very good track record, but how was it that you came to actually work on Heroes? Because let's face it, this is a classic example of people trusting you, and that's so important. How did you guys come to work on Heroes in the first place?
Well, Tim Kring, his previous show was Crossing Jordan, and Stargate had done the effects for Crossing Jordan all six seasons. So there was a level of trust there, particularly with Tim and with Laurie Motier, who the co-producer who really oversees post-production, and she just really trusts the company. She's worked with some of the people here before there was a Stargate films when she was just coming up into the industry. You know, she was really studying the business under the president of our company here, who used to be a show producer. So there's a tremendous level of trust with that group of people.
Now, your facility is well placed, obviously, and it's done beautiful work on this series of Heroes. But there's also this Heroes Origins sort of linking series, I guess you'd call it. Are you guys going to be involved with that?
I think they're still sorting out exactly what that show is going to be. I think they probably have story outlines, but I don't think they've determined yet whether it's going to be the same producer or a different production team. I think those questions will all be answered over the next probably 3 or 4 weeks. We were happy to hear this morning that the producer for Heroes called the office to let us know when they were starting production again, which is a happy sign that we'll be there for season two. So that's good.
I can't thank you guys enough for taking time out to talk to us. I know that you're really busy, and we really do appreciate it. And it's certainly been something that I've been looking to find out about because, you know, I'm torn between just being a genuine fan of the show and enjoying the plot lines and the acting, and also just loving what you guys come up with each week. And I think the challenges of episodic are so stiff, and you've come through so amazingly with some of the shots that...
Well, thank you.
And, of course, as you mentioned yourself before, that's only the stuff I could tell you did. I'm
yeah,
sure
exactly.
There's a lot more that I don't know about. But we do really appreciate you taking time to talk to us, so thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for letting us talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
Thanks, guys. Well, that'll do it for this week's FX Podcast. For Mike Seymour, John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.